Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. As most of you know, every episode is highlighting somebody exceptional. Today is no exception. Today's guest is Joe Loya, who is the author of The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell, Confessions of a Bank Robber. Joe has a great deal to say about so many aspects of life that we're just going to start in, and if we don't finish it, I'm going to ask him to come back. And I'm going to go to you, Joe, but I do want to say that when I first heard about you, and here you are, a young, kind of hip-looking man, and I heard that you were a bank robber, the first thing I thought of was, my goodness, that is just so yesterday, bank robber. Talk about
okay,
you.
Okay, you know, the thing about that is, I'm not... Okay, I see what you say yesterday. So Billy the Kid and all those guys,
yes.
Right back in the day, they were robbing, you know, Wells Fargo stage coaches and stuff.
Because there was no other
choice. Yeah, but then, you know, in the 20s, it was a big deal. I get that, too. It was a time when bank robbers were folk heroes. But the thing that makes it not yesterday is the media or what we have done with bank robbers. Because if you remember John Dillinger, when he was caught, he was shot outside of a theater where he'd been watching Clark Gable play a bank robber.
Oh.
So ever since then, Paul Newman, Robert Redford played bank robbers. Butch Cassidy's Sundance Kid. Robert De Niro's played a bank robber in Heat. Al Pacino, Dog Day Afternoon.
Right.
So Hollywood hunks have been playing bank robbers forever.
Oh, so there's
Clooney,
yeah,
and
okay.
Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11. In Ocean's 12, 13, whatever. The point
so
is...
So the strength of it is still right there in front of you.
Yeah, but there's a romanticization,
yes,
of the bank robber in the American consciousness.
Yes.
So, and it plays out, you see it in Hollywood today, even when Hollywood hunks are not playing bank robbers. Everybody's playing a bank robber. Every year there's three or four movies about bank robbery.
You're
there,
right,
was one like in Now You See Me was out recently with this Eisenberg kid.
Yeah.
There was one a couple years ago. I think Eisenberg was in two because he was also in another movie where they got some pizza guy to rob a bank or something like that. I forget. But the point is, at least, because I pay attention to this because I'm also a movie reviewer, three or four movies a year of bank robbery. It is fresh in the imagination.
So that is part of the American.
It's part of the, yeah, it's part of the American. So in that way, it's not yesterday. It's actually,
yeah,
relevant. And also as a crime.
But is there a lot of it today still?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, when I got out of prison, the interesting thing.
Picture hacking, you know?
No, it's. I mean, if you look at, if you've been following the trends, like girls giggling or robbing phones, old 85-year-old men are robbing banks. Everybody's robbing banks now.
I was so unaware
like,
of that.
It's everybody's robbing banks.
What was your first? What brought you to that? What made you take that decision?
Okay, now that is another story.
Okay,
you have to get a bit
of
that. Because it's a real lead up to that. Like
okay.
My criminal life, the evolution of my criminal life that brought me to the moment where I said, I'm now in Mexico, I'm a fugitive. I'll just give you the outline of
yeah.
it. I'm now in Mexico, I'm now a fugitive. And I've been robbed. I need to make money fast. I can't go and hustle people anymore in California. I don't have time to defraud people. You got to become friends and stuff. So I was how can I get the most money the fastest?
Okay.
In Mexico, I came up to the United States to rob my first bank. But,
wait a minute. Can I just say hold your horses? Because you've just touched on about eight things.
That's what I'm saying.
Each of which is a whole life. But
exactly.
You talked about you couldn't hustle people anymore. You want to just start with you as a boy?
No, I don't have time.
You don't have time for that. Okay.
No.
All
I mean,
right.
You're asking this half hour. I do
okay.
not have time for that.
Okay.
It would be a half hour story by itself. What I want to talk about is the love letters. And
yes.
you know, it's interesting you said love letters live. Our love letters live.
Yes.
And I read it as love letters live.
We intended for either because we thought if we had a call-in show, it would be live, and we didn't, and they thought of, and they do live. They still live.
They
and
live
they
that.
Live forever.
I love letters.
They
love
live for generations, as it turns out.
Here's what I want to say a couple things about that.
What?
When I was in prison, I had correspondence with a woman who visited me for 6 years, and I knew her when we were 13.
Mm-hmm.
I was a very abused kid. She knew all about it. I eventually, at age 16, during a very vicious beating in which my dad, you know, broke some bones, and I stabbed him in the neck when I was 16. I tried to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
He survived, but we went into foster care, and he never hit us again. It was the end of that, mm-hmm. the brutality, and it was the beginning now of my criminality. I changed within. My rage was now out, and I became a bullied boy up to that point who could mm-hmm. now act out my violence in the world. Well, she came to visit me, and in prison, and for 6 years, we had a correspondence, and it's love letters.
Yes, it is.
But I also had a correspondence with Richard Rodriguez, the essayist. He does, for a long time, he did the McNair NewsHour. He would do the video essays for them at the end, some of them. Richard's a fantastic essayist. We had this correspondence. And they were love letters of a sort, too.
Now, so let's talk about that for a moment. When you said they were love letters of a sort, how do you define a love letter?
Well, that's what I want to talk about, right? Yeah. Is that when you think about love letters, people are so stuck on the notion of romance.
Right.
Okay. I have right now, I'm married and I love my wife. She's great. But I have many love stories playing out in my life that have nothing to do with romance and have nothing to do with any of it. They're just love stories. There's this,
love takes so many forms.
The woman who visited me in prison, I thought I was going to marry her when I came out. We didn't end up getting married. We end up becoming friends.
Yes.
And our friendship from 13 to we're 52 now, and everything we went through and whatever, that's a love story right there.
Yes,
I have another friend. I knew her. I had a crush on her when I was in ninth grade. And our lives split apart, and then we came back together about 10 years ago. And that's a love story. Another friend, like, and with men.
Yes.
I have love stories that are men that are good friends that I've known for a long time. They're a particular kind. So I call love stories are, to me, and love letters are just based on the notion of love, not romance and sex. That's where people get confused about that. So the love letters between Richard and I were letters in which we were open and vulnerable. We shared with each other, because you can share with strangers sometimes things you can't share with friends. We both discovered that in the letters and both wrote about that. Because I didn't see him. He didn't visit me. Nothing. We didn't talk on the phone. It was just old-fashioned letters.
Yes, and there's that whole history of pen pals.
Yeah, there's
before,
a pen pal.
Before you were born or when you were, I don't know how old
No, that would be a pen pal relationship.
That would. But it used to be kind of formalized in school in the 40s.
Oh, okay.
We used to be given a choice of who do you want for a pen pal, and we were given lists of people, and we chose one, and it was just for the joy of communicating.
Yeah.
And sometimes pen pals meet 50 years later, and they're already like family.
You see, that's it.
Yes.
You get to know people differently on the page. So anyway, there's that. So love letters is an interesting thing to me, and I do feel like some relationships that I'm in right now are love letters. You know, Thoreau wrote that thing, "My life is the poem I would have writ, but I could not both live and utter it," or something like that. Something like that, I forget. Which I totally agree with. I call bullshit on that, Thoreau. That our lives can be poems, and we can live them like love letters to each other. And I think that one of the love letters is my relationship with my father. Because my dad and I had this horrible combat in the bedroom when I was 16. He was only 33 at the time, 32 maybe, or 33. He's only 16 years older than me, and I would turn 17 that summer. So he was 33, I was 16, stabbed him in the neck, leave him on the ground bleeding. He screamed out, you killed me," and then I go and we get the police involved and everything. And we get into foster care, and I'm angry at the man. I think he's a monster, and I start to portray him because now that I own the story,
monster for the abuse that you suffered.
Now, my mother had passed away when I was 9, and the grief in the home bothered him. It burdened him. He eventually turned, I started acting against his conscience in ways that, he
regrets. Do you
remember
what he was like before your mother died?
He was very strict, but he was very religious, and God had he had allowed God to keep his anger in check. His rage in check, because he'd been brutalized as a kid. So, but my mother left, and there was just too much stress on him, and he cracked, he just didn't know. He was immature. He didn't have anyone who had modeled anything to him. His faith was, being totally tested. I mean, prayers were not being answered. They were praying for God to heal her, and she was just dying. For 2.5 years, he watched her die. It was horrible. It was painful. I understand that now, but I did not understand that as a kid. And so the only way
I can't understand.
I was a kid. That's what I mean. Well, not only that, I don't care how bright you are as a kid. You're a kid.
Right,
you don't have maturity. You don't have anything. You're not going to really understand your parent until you become a parent. If you really, the truth of it, doesn't matter how bright you are. You can't understand the goals they gave up, the sacrifices they made, the dreams that they had to reconcile. Like, okay, I'm going to have to let that go because they have kids and they've chosen a responsibility. You don't know any of that until they're born. Until you have a kid. If you're aware, if you're self-aware, if you're willing to go there, that's when it happened. But anyway, so I'm a kid. I'm angry at my dad. And I do the obvious thing. I'm not even hard on myself for doing it. I portrayed him as a monster in my book. He did horrible things to me. I'm never going to do that to a kid. How could you treat your blood like that? I said all sorts of horrible things. But when I turned him into a monster, instead of a man who acted against his conscience, but mostly did really, really good, instead of doing that, I created the occasion for me to look at myself as a monster when I started being bad, acting out, acting against my conscience, hurting people who loved me, all of that. I became a monster. So I hated myself. I hated my dad. This rage just fueled itself. And I went on a tear. I robbed 30 banks in 14 months. And had a, went to prison first for a couple of years. Then got out for 14 months. Robbed all the banks.
Went to prison for 7. Got out, did the same thing. Went to
No, so I robbed. I had this crime career, a criminal career, mm-hmm. a petty crime first. The day before they arrested me, I robbed my first bank. Mm-hmm. They didn't arrest me for the bank robbery. They arrested me for all those other things that they wanted me for. So when I went to prison, I had got away with that bank robbery. For 2 years, I sat in my bunk and said, I'm never going to have to do petty crime again. I know what I'm going to do when I get out. Uh-huh. So I got out, boom, the gun went off, and I was on a 14-month bank robbery spree and robbed 30 banks, approximately 30. I lost count of 30. The FBI had me between 30 and 40. Anyway, so I do the 7 years. I plead guilty to 3 bank robberies that they were able to pin on me. And I go to prison. And in prison, I'm angry. I'm still a criminal. I'm committing crimes. I get pulled in a homicide investigation. My ex-cellmate was murdered. And 5 or 6 of us Mexican guys get pulled up. None of us had anything to do with it. But it took them 2 years to figure that out. They got the guy who actually did the murder. They put him in, locked him up in solitary. He had been in the general population. And they let us out. In that 2 years, I changed my life. I gave up. I was like, I'm done. This is too hard. Plus, I was looking at 99 years. If they found a way to railroad me, I was looking at 99 years of prison. So I gave up. And in giving up and starting to write about my story, starting to write my stories out, I saw all these places in my narrative as a boy where my dad was lovely.
Oh, I want to talk about, yes.
Lovely. He was playful. Oh. When my mother died, and this is one of our funny things. When my mother died, he would wake up on Saturday morning. He would like to. He took us to the symphony. He took us to the symphony where they had somebody tell a story for kids, mm-hmm. and you got exposed to the symphony.
How many?
I have a younger brother, a year and a half younger than me.
So 2 of you.
So
okay.
2 of us. He loved, in the morning he would wake up after when my mother was in the hospital or after she died. Freaks, come to my bed, freaks, and we would run over there and we'd wrestle on the bed and we'd play with him in the morning. Then we'd go have breakfast somewhere. He loved. My dad's a very playful man, love, very demonstrative, very affectionate like me.
Like you. I'm so glad you said that.
There's just like, my dad's a very open person, and you see why what he did
like
was
you.
Not, yeah, what he did was not because he was a monster. He was a man who acted against his conscience and did monstrous things.
Right.
But if you look at him, I see how my grandfather saw the sweetness in his son and could not handle it and tried to turn my dad into some macho guy who my grandfather wanted my dad to be. But my dad was actually a very sweet child.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sweetness in him. In fact, if you meet everyone who meets him and they know the story, they're like, how did that man do that to you? The same thing about me. They meet me now. They're like, how did you do all those horrible things? That's what happened. That's how it happens.
I have a question, which is that I think about with parents who are particularly tormented over the loss of a spouse or even a divorce,
mm-hmm.
when the child looks like the parent who died, is that extra pain?
Probably. In some cases, I'm sure it is,
uh-huh.
in some ways.
To look
it's
at
a reminder,
and see
yeah.
her, yes.
It could be,
she
certainly.
Was gorgeous. I saw
my
that
mother,
picture
she,
of her. Oh.
In ninth grade, she was like the queen of her little school there, and she, Tower Queen, they called
oh,
her.
Gorgeous.
She was very beautiful, yeah. What ends up happening is when I'm in prison, all my life when I was younger and I was trying, I knew that I was starting to kind of like mess up. I've been raised in a Christian home. My dad, in fact, had been a pastor of a church for a minute. When I would repent, I'd always ask God to help me forgive my dad, forgive. In prison, I had this idea that I finally let go of wanting to forgive my father. People ask me today, how did you forgive your father? In fact, this is how Frank McCourt and I became friends. Frank was at the Sun Valley Writers Conference. I was there with the novelist Mark Salzman. I don't know, do you know Mark Salzman? Iron and Silk. But he also did this thing about a nun who was seeing God, but she was having brain tumor. I forget the name of that novel. Anyway, Mark Salzman and I were in conversation on the stage, and he said, how did you forgive your father? And I said, I didn't forgive my father. And he's like, what? And I said, I don't believe in forgiveness. I actually think forgiveness was the reason I could not let go. Because here's why I look at forgiveness. Forgiveness to me is located in the Empyrean Heights as a higher theme. I think forgiveness, unlike compassion and love and some other higher themes, I think it's rooted in vanity, because in order to forgive someone, you first have to take it personal.
Something else too. I was just
looking. And the other thing about forgiveness to me that I felt was there's this sense in forgiveness where I'm saying the universe is off balance now, and in order to write the moral universe, I need to bestow on you forgiveness. And so now there's moral order. Now, I mean, it's okay, like so, the vanity of that is gargantuan.
I know. So that's what I'm so glad you said, let me finish. That's what I was going to, because I talk about in love letters, when we write letters of forgiveness, it's a beautiful thing to do. And we have to do it without using the word forgive. It's a little too righteous.
I don't even
to set yourself up.
As I get it. The one I get
who, yes.
So I don't believe I ever. I don't believe.
I'm so glad.
I don't do that. Forgiveness. And good. People say, how do you know? I don't do forgiveness. What I did was this.
Understanding.
I looked at my father. Mm-hmm. I realized as a boy, he was a sweet boy, like me.
Yeah.
I saw that he had a father who didn't know how to deal with his sweetness, like mine. Mm-hmm. Immature, who was insecure as a father. And so he tried to turn his boy to be tougher and worked against his kid. And the kid ended up learning the behavior that was modeled to him was of an angry, tyrannical, volatile drunkard father. My dad didn't drink, but he was like a dry drunk, I guess is what they call him. Mm-hmm. He had all the sort of mood swings of a drunk. And so when I realized that that's what my dad had, how could he be anything but that was modeled to him? That's all that was modeled to me. I became what was modeled to me. I didn't even have any choice. All that influence came under the radar. There was no volition in me choosing that. It was all I knew. Same with my dad. Once I was able to see that, I didn't take anything he did to me personally. Because the truth is, you could have lined up 100 sons there, and all of them would have been beat the same. It had nothing to do with me.
Okay, so you're getting to the point where he didn't do something to you, he did something from him.
He did something from him, and I actually had compassion. I'm like, man, you did that to us, and you have to live with that. You promised my mother you would take care of us, and you did that to us? Oh my God.
Were you able to say that out loud to him?
Not until later, yeah. But this came to me in prison, and I let it settle in me. And I realized the more I let it settle in me, I lost all it. The anger and everything dissolved because I was no longer operating from a position of, this happened to me and I need to do the bigger thing, the bigger thing. And if I do it and I marshal all my moral goodwill, mm-hmm. watching my moral righteousness, watch me, I'm going to tackle this thing and I'm going to actually raise you up with me. Like that just, and to me, it rings so fucking vain. Anyway, so... I love my dad. Yeah, I mean, what happened, what grew out of that was a genuine compassion and love for him.
Now, he's still living?
He's alive. So when I go to L.A., we have dim sum. We had dim sum just 3 weeks ago when I was in L.A. I always get together.
Is he able to talk to you about what was?
Yeah, we talked. Ever since then. When we got out, in fact, it was like, Dad, check this out. You did bad things. I've done bad things. Let's cancel them out. Mine cancels yours. Yours cancels mine. Began to start all over again. And we did. And I want to talk about a moment. My daughter was 3 years old, 4 years old, and we took her down there, my wife and I, and we took my dad out to the park with her. And my wife and I were on this little hill, a little picnic table, and down the little grassy knoll into the sand area where the kids play, there's my dad and my daughter on the swings holding hands. Mm-hmm. She wanted him to hold hands with her, but they swung. And I looked down there at my dad, and I turned to my wife and I said, look at that man. That's a good man. If I had been his father, I would have adored the sweetness in him, and he would have grown up to be a giant. And that's what I can say now about my father. I see nothing but the sweetness and goodness in him. I call him regularly when I talk about my childhood now. My calls are, hey, Dad, that thing you did was really great when I was a kid, and guess what? It's showing up in my parenting with my daughter. It's rippling through me. And in some instances, I call him and say, oh my God, Dad, you know that thing you did? I did it to my daughter, and now she's doing it to my wife. Like, playful stuff.
Yes.
There was a thing where I crashed my car once when I was 18, totaled it. I walked home midnight. I walked in. I was living with my grandmother. My dad was staying with us for a while. And I walked in at midnight, dejected. I totaled my Mustang, my 66 Mustang. And I was in a slightly, probably a slight concussion. Why the hell was I walking home 2 miles after a car accident, which I totaled my car? But I get home. I open the door, dejected. And there's my dad lying, pretending like he's asleep, with his leg up in the air like it had rigor mortis, right? And it just... That was my dad. He just wanted to make you laugh, make you smile, chase a laugh. So when my daughter was a baby, she would come out of the, bathtub, would come running to the living room, and I would put my head back, pretend I was asleep, and I would put my leg up. Just yesterday morning, she, "Dada, I'm awake," she yells out in the morning. So I go to her room, I turn the light on, there she is lying down with her leg. she's got leg rigor mortis. Like, that stuff happens all the time, where I see my dad is now rippled through me to her in these positive, playful ways. I want to say one thing about laughter. One last thing. My dad and my brother
and I... You could talk for a week. I'd still be listening.
My dad, my brother, and I, after I got out of prison, we were laughing about the beatings. We got dark humor. We were laughing about the beatings. My dad has polio in his right arm. So we were joking that when he used to hit us, we actually only felt like it was half bad. Because he would hit us with his left arm, and that one really hurt. But then he would throw this noodle at us, and we were like, okay, good, we got a reprieve. We would pretend like it would hurt. Oh. And then he would hit us with the left, we were laughing, and he lifts up his left hand when we're having dinner. Me and my brother and I, this is like 16 years ago. And he starts opening and closing his fist, and he says, "I think it's time to institute corporal punishment again." And my brother says, put that manito down, put that little hand down. He said, "I took your best blows, you know, 30 years ago, old man. You ain't got nothing, no gas left in that tank." And we laughed. We laughed our asses off of the terror of a moment that was total terror in our life.
But now you're able to do that because at some point you are dear enough and smart enough and insightful enough to know that that wasn't the whole of him.
And not at all.
Right. And
barely.
It's so hard. It's so hard when somebody is wailing on you. You can't at that moment see anything else. You know, your own pain is the center of the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's that.
It's understandable.
Yes. So what would you, I mean, I'm just drooling at the prospect here. You're a writer. You're a beautiful writer. You express yourself right to the point. Mm-hmm. Nothing gets past you. And
Thank you. You
know when to call something false. So this letter, have you ever written a letter to your father?
I've written many letters to my dad,
You have?
I mean, you know, emails and letters, I mean, I wrote them in prison. Prison, I wrote letters. And I let him know, for example, that, I realized that when I learned in prison that anger actually disguised grief, disguised the wound, that anger's false. It's just chimera, man. It's like, it's not even, it's not real to me. If I get angry, I'm like, okay, I'm wounded. Where is it?
Now, those are all in your own handwriting.
They were all in my handwriting.
Because handwriting is king here.
Handwriting is what I'm about. I mean, that's I got all the copies of letters that I sent to Richard, 600 pages.
Oh,
I would write Richard. I would write a 20-page letter to Richard, and that would be my fourth draft. I meant I had 60, 70 pages behind it of handwritten letters.
Because I think the best love letters are a combination of passion and planning, and so that you go through things and you go through things so you can really, you know, kind of take out what you really want to say and be thoughtful about it. But have you ever written to your father about just his wonderful qualities that you remember from time? I'm thinking a series of letters to your dad. You know, I remember this. And the gift is for parents, and I've done a lot with this, the gift is always, I didn't know you remembered that. And I didn't know you knew that. And actual love letters just about his wonderful qualities.
I've never done a series of letters like that to him over the years.
Memories.
I've done some memories
of his.
And of course, in the book, the memories come out, and I'm very, very specific about these amazing things he did that I love, that I cherish.
There's something about seeing and writing from a child, where you've had a conflicted and difficult relationship. There's something about, for a parent, seeing in writing.
Yeah, he's never ever talked about the things I've written about Beautiful. He doesn't talk about them that way, but I know he appreciates it.
Yes.
And I know he appreciates mostly my ethos. My ethos is, Dad, and this is my dad's end game. He's not at the beginning of his life.
Right.
And he's had some illness. He's only 69, but he's, you know, he's not 69, which means our family, I mean, we're lucky that he's 69. He had open heart surgery at 55. He had his first heart attack at 44.
Oh, my goodness.
He's got a lot of health issues. So 69 is, and in our family, you know, you live to be 80 years old in our family. When my wife's family, it's the opposite. You live to 80, you're like, ooh, I got 20 years left
to go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not kidding. They live to 101, 99, 96.
So that's good for your daughter.
That's good for my daughter and my wife.
Yeah.
But my family, my mom died at 26. My dad almost died at 55. So, and then aunts and uncles for days died between 40 and 70.
Terrible.
So the point I'm making, though, is this. Even that is I spend my conversations with my dad doing nothing but reminding him and letting him know, Dad, I love you because you did some amazing things and it helps me be a great father.
Okay, so that alone, I mean, I'm just saying that in your handwriting, a letter that says just that in your handwriting is going to be gold to everybody. Does he have all your letters?
I don't know what he, I'm sure he doesn't.
Yeah.
I'm sure he doesn't. But, I mean, you're giving me an idea, but and it goes right up there with the five, six other books I have.
I
got love letters from my daughter right now that I'm working on. So,
and that's a whole other thing, you know, love letters to
Matilde.
No, I'm thinking of two. Oh, is that what's his name?
My daughter's name is Matilde. My dad's Joe Senior.
Oh, is it okay?
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, love letters, a series of love letters, even just as an appendix to any book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the love letters to your dad that say specifics, and you're big on specifics. I can see that.
Yeah, yeah, no, I am specific.
You know, you're so special, it doesn't mean anything.
No.
You're
unique. I'm like, that's the right word. Uh-huh. Most unfavorite word.
Oh,
unique.
I have a whole list. I'm sure you do too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But specifics, you know, and in particular, that all the good that you are is what, in fact, has really formed the real me.
Yeah, no, that's.
Oh.
I mean, that, you're giving me an idea.
I hope you do it.
We'll see.
I know you're busy writing a lot of things.
Man, I got so many writing, but that's a great idea. I actually never entertained that.
And of course, bathing in the positive, as you know.
Yeah, I'm about the positive.
I know.
I mean, that's the way you survive in this world. Is you have to be optimistic. And here's the thing: when people, my life is so hard. I'm like, hey, listen, I'm not going to shit on anybody's hard life because I had a hard life and there was a moment where I thought I had the worst life. But what I do tell people is this. Yes, it's hard. I get it. I was in solitary confinement for 2 years, miserable, hallucinating, broke. I broke in solitary. My mother died. I was sexually abused. My dad beat the hell out of me. I stabbed him at 16. I suffered hearing all the grief around me in McLaren Hall, which was where kids go after they've been abused and they're taken out of. That center was just one maelstrom of grief of little kids who had been burnt and beaten and tortured. I've experienced suffering and grief and human squalor at such a level, and I'm probably one of the most optimistic people you're ever going to meet.
That's right. Cheerful and smiling and a powerful, powerful man for it. But what do you attribute? I mean, you said something earlier that I wanted to say, bingo, I don't know who gets the thank you letter, but you were also blessed with an exceptional temperament.
So my dad. I got my dad. That's my dad.
That's your dad. Even that, you know, for all the difficulties that there was, dad.
That's not my dad. Let me be more specific. My personality is my dad's. But the temperament is those early years when my mother was around. The love
I'm just saying, even genetically, you get something.
Like I'm saying, the love between my mother was a sweeter. Anybody, by any measure, my grandmother died saying, at least I gave birth to a saint. My mother was a gem of a person. So I was raised at home. She and my dad were a real love story.
Aww.
They met when they were 12. They got married at 16 when my mother was pregnant. They loved each other dearly. That was a part of the drama and trauma of my dad watching the woman he loved who got him in all his confusion and everything.
Yeah.
She saw that sweetness too. They connected in their home in those early years before she got sick at 7. I was loved. Oh, it was an erotic love. It was just flowing through me. It was everywhere around me. It was in their affection. It was in our play. It was all around me. I couldn't even help being this guy.
So is that part of your book? Have you written all this down?
This
aspect?
You have to read the memoir.
I'm
absolutely
going to. Oh,
absolutely.
I'm going to read everything you've ever written. And will. Yes. Oh, Joe, thank you so much for doing this for me.
You're welcome. I'm about the big love. Everyone knows I'm about the big love. Who knows me?
One of the most amazing men I've ever met.
Oh,
this is just exceptional. You are such a beacon of light. And all I can say is thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And I just want to remind people that if you think you have to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, The writing love letter is always a special occasion. Writing about the love you have for someone else and what it is you love about that person is absolutely a healing moment when you need a healing moment. So this is Janet Gallen.
And I want to say one thing. I've been inspired. I'm going to go home and write a couple of love letters in the next few days. I've been inspired.
I'm so glad.
This is amazing.
That's what this is all about.
Yeah,
I hope you do. Because, taking this, you know so much about your dad that I don't know that other children who have lived the horror you have lived, in the moments that were horror, I don't know that they're so aware of what you can do with this.
Well, yeah, you can play with it. You can have fun.
And forgiveness, ultimately, is...
Compassion.
I'm saying forgiveness is ultimately understanding and compassion. Yes. Thank you, dear. Talk
You're
to
welcome.
You next week.
Bye-bye.